Hey, I'm Steve Bajant. I'm the Stony Brook University, and I'm acting as the moderator today. So I'm doing the very light lifting. I'd like to introduce the participants to this construction of class consciousness. John Beck, associate professor in the School of Labor and Industrial Relations at Michigan State, joined the faculty in 1991, and serves as the associate director of the school, in charge of the two outreach units, labor education programs and the program on innovative employee relation systems. He coordinates as an MSU museum adjunct curator our daily work, our daily life program, which explores the culture of workers in the workplace. I have joined the staff of the school, John is the education research director of the United Paper Workers International Union. Karen Beach was born and raised in Glasgow, Scotland, MA Hons in English Literature, then an MLit in American Studies from Glasgow, moved to Bracken as a pavilion in October 2008, and pursued a DPhil in American Studies at the University of Sussex. Interested in social function, played by poetry within the American left of the early 20th century, side interest within the philosophy of consciousness, which also informs the work. Magnus Nielsen, PhD in Comp Lit from Lund in Sweden in 2003, currently assistant professor in the Department of International Migration and Ethnic Relations at Malmö University in Sweden. Was Fulbright at UCLA in 2009, and from this fall in October, visiting scholar, and I'm not going to try and get my tongue around the university that's in Munster in Germany. Author of three books in Swedish about working class literature. Recent years he's been published mainly on migration literature. Recently began writing a book on Swedish working class literature during the era of Swedish workers' state. Michael Boyle, raised in a small working class town of Sunsbury, Pennsylvania, presently a PhD student in cultural anthropology at the grad center at CUNY, 2009, 10 academic years fellow at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the CUNY Grad Center. The research focuses on questions of class, political economy, Christianity, political consciousness in the context of radical liberalism. Currently bringing these things together for his dissertation, ethnographically based treatment in the intersection of the evangelical Protestant, charity class relations in post-industrial city of Canton, Ohio. In his dissertation is also a dissertation. I grew up in a working class town in the north of England. In fact, where I live, I go down the hill and can meet the direct descendants of General Ludd. I grew up in the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, and we have some historical roots there. John.
Okay. Well, off to the races. It's great to have you all here. Thanks for coming. Does everybody have the two listings of books? Okay. One is alphabetical, the other is chronological. I put together this presentation called Murdering Labor, How Contemporary Unions Have Fared in the American Mystery Novel, 1979 to 2009. And what struck me was the fact that, you know, in earlier historical periods, there have been naturally a lot of very, very stirring novels, and a lot of stirring novels and poetry being written right now by many people even in the room. counterculture often is a strong reflection of what's going on within the overall society. And during my time on union staff, prior to that as a worker, you know, we took it on the chin pretty much in the last 30 years in the United States, and Bill Fletcher has alluded to it earlier today in his remarks, goes on as well. And I wanted to see, from a popular culture point of view, how have unions been played out? How have industrial relations notions been played out in popular culture? Now, you know, often we can go back and look at, you know, whether it be working class kind of sitcoms like Roseanne or others, the fact that you've got the constant barfly postman in the case of Cheers. But I really wanted to look at mystery novels because I had read a few. Tim Shearer has written a number of novels that are on the list. But I got very, very curious then about how many have been written. You know, and there wasn't necessarily a good bibliography at all when I started to try to mine around for them. And it's been an interesting hymns teeth kind of fight for almost the last year while I got prepared for this topic to even identify and find them, okay? So I want to just give you a kind of overview of what's on this list. That is, what are you looking at in terms of where are many of these coming from? Who are these people as novelists? And more importantly, in my mind, you know, what kinds of, you know, in some cases they're exemplars, in other cases they're really some awful ones. Now, unions did not necessarily figure in that strongly even in earlier mysteries. The one that that I would raise for you way back is, of course, Dashiell Hammett. Hammett, in his novel Red Harvest, the hero of the novel actually shows up in the town after the strike is over. And the strike is over, but many of the gun thugs and goons have stayed behind and have basically become criminals in that time and place. So thinking of Hammett, thinking of other things like that, I decided to really look at what was going on in this mystery literature of the last 30 years. So, two disclaimers. Number one, I didn't include in my quick overview any of the mystery novels that were written in the period that looked at historical kind of situations. Because there's actually a good amount of them that exist that look at things going on in the 1960s, the things going on, To the Love of Mike, for example, actually looked at, by Rice Brown, looked at the Triangle Shirtwaist time period and organizing. Okay, so there are a number of them that would fit into that looked like at historical settings, but I didn't include those. Because, in fact, I wanted to see how was legal relations and unions, how were we looked at by contemporary novels to try to reflect that period. I did not include those that were simply on contemporary workers and workplaces that didn't include any kind of labor relations feel to them. For example, I included one. I let one sneak onto the list. I'll mention that one to you now. David Lynn's book, Wrestling with Gabriel, is the most literary, probably, of the specific novels that are on this list. It's on meatpacking, organizing by socialists in a small town in Iowa. But they mention kind of unions, but it doesn't necessarily have a lot of the things that I'm about to mention as major events or kind of a facet. Another one, Donald Harstead's very, very fine book, A Cold December, that again was at meatpacking, but no unions in sight. Even though great descriptions in both cases, by the way, at the kill floor, and other things in relation to what's going on in those places. So I didn't include, like I said, historical ones for some of the fans of Mysteries in the Room. If you have not read, for example, Karen Rose Sircone's, she had a three-novel series about the Pittsburgh area and Pennsylvania, and probably one of the earliest wonderful writers of the late 70s, Gordon DeMarco from the West Coast, who did the Riley Kovacs novels that I would commend to you. His novel, October Heat, was absolutely wonderful about the Embarcadero strike. And again, historical in nature rather than contemporary. Now, and I very well may have missed a few, but But I posted this, the query for these novels through the Labor and Employment Research Association, which includes both employers and unions and others. I went through the Mystery Writers of America and did not necessarily get a lot of helpful suggestions from folks. Got some, which I will mention in passing. Okay, so what did I look at? I was looking for those novels that had either organizing and representation elections, collective bargaining as a major event within the mystery, strikes, grievance handling and general representation within the workplace, union politics and elections, union involvement in electoral politics, manipulation of union monies, including pension plans, and the whole relationship, often therefore, to some type of mob links or mob corruption. And last but not least, very interesting ones that Chair Lincoln and I are going to be talking about because of her current project, corporate takeovers and plant closures. Okay. Now, in the 28 novels, I believe it was 28 that I had on the list in front of you, sectors covered included one on airlines, seven on construction, one on entertainment, basically on Hollywood, one on ferry workers, transportation, one on founders, four on healthcare by Tim Shearer, one on higher education, specifically the organizing of graduate students, one on longshore, one on meatpacking, one on mining, three on public education by Zubrow, and I mentioned him because, in fact, I think he's a very, very important novelist on this list. Two having to do with restaurants or hotels, one having to do with sex workers, specifically strippers, one having to do with software and high tech, and two having to do with steel. And both of those on the deindustrialization of steel, post-spec, rather than actually what we're planning on specifically within the workplace. Now, what did I find? I mean, there's 28 novels. What kinds of things were going on in these that I might want to mention to you? This is what I think might be the most important single thing after now having read this entire literature. For the most part, authors understand, or these authors at least understood, the underlying processes of labor relations and labor law. With some refreshing exemplars, Zubrow, I would point out to you, really understands how workplace representation works and the kind of problems of having a grievance or having a member say, you work for me, I pay my dues and it pays your salary, or it I keep you in office, kind of thing. He actually covers public education. And the other thing about the Zubrow novels that I recommend to you is that the hero is gay and is ultimately married in the series later on to a pro baseball player. So it's a very, very interesting series because of the fact that it's got the whole dynamics of being gay fiction as well as being mystery fiction, as well as having in three of the novels in the series some form of labor relations, all of it for the most part having to do with union representation, except for the fact that union elections figure into one. His best novel I would commend to you is his novel, Are You Nuts, off that list, which really goes at representation, union elections, and other things. Now, there are some glaring exceptions to the fact that most of these novelists get it right. Sandra Brown, awful romance novelist that she is, writes kind of romantic mysteries, and White Hot has some of the worst top-down union organizing that you will ever see, and in a way that it doesn't exist at all, in fact. And so it's just an awful novel to have to get through. But in the case of the Shear novels and the Zubrow novels, there is a recognition for the politics, ambiguity, and hard work that goes into workplace problem solving. So in that way, there very are interesting novels to be able to have students or co-workers read to make sure that people understand how tough is it to be a union steward. Now, from Tim's latest novel, Slim to None, let me just read the one thing that I think captures kind of the tough role that a union rep is in. in Tim's case, he has a shop steward named Lenny Moss that works on as a janitor in the hospital, often has to intervene on the side of workers throughout the novels, but many times then ends up being involved in murder cases because of the fact that one of his co-workers or himself end up being falsely accused. So you have to find the bad guy to get your colleague, get your fellow worker off the hook. So from Tim's novel comes the following quote. Malcolm, in this case, is one of Tim's stepchildren. And Malcolm is a young boy who is playing, in this case, with his action figures, as you'll find out. From a seat at the top of the stairs, Malcolm heard the entire interview with the detective in the home, coming to talk to Lane Moss about a murder situation. He held two of his action heroes, Flamethrower and Mothman, imagining that they were joining the fight to save Lenny's friend. Looking at the figures clutched in his fists, the child decided his collection was badly incomplete. The world needed a Lenny Moss action figure, arguing that there should be a Chuck Stewart action figure, I think. Very good. So, for the most part, then, most of the authors on the list, like I said, understand the underlying processes that they're using as events or backdrops for the actual mystery. Now, many of the novels that I looked at have characters who link the current situation of workers in the 1979 to the present. Well, it turned out the first one was written by Sarah Paresky in 1982, so I think I can wait a couple of years to finish the study of 30 years. But many of them linked the contemporary worker struggles to former worker struggles or former times. So in Robert Tannenbaum's novel, Absolute Rage, he has a crusty old labor lawyer who takes the hero, one of the two heroes aside, and is talking about a rank and file activist, local union guy, who ends up being killed in the novel. But and I'll mention more about that in a second. But here and this goes into a three-page of the novel kind of history lesson. I'll just give you a quick paragraph of it. So this is the labor lawyer trying to entice his friend, who's a lawyer, into this whole case. I'll tell you one thing about Red Haney, he says. He was the real stuff, you know. The goddamn pathetic labor movement we got in this great land of ours, they're all waiting for the one, like the Jews waited for Moses. They don't expect the revolution anymore, but they're not that stupid. They just want a labor leader who won't make them sick, who won't be found with his hand in the pensions or in bed with the mob. A mensch, a Gene Debs, a Walter Reuther, a working class leader with arms on him. Not one of those shifty-eyed bozos in sharp suits they got in there now, and not one of your middle-class, well-meaning types either. Okay, and then this goes on for two more pages of kind of historical, contextual work that Tannenbaum is putting in the voice of a labor leader, a labor lawyer, to link the current back to much more history. So in many of these novels, there is that kind of recognition and that link. Now, in some cases that I looked at, these instances of harking back place the current situation in the long march of history, while in other cases, characters find themselves failing in light of their betrayal of the rightness and earlier clarity of cause. Many times, their current failings have their roots in the not-so-clear past. So Sarah Paresky, in Identity Only, and this is speaking from labor leader. Maybe I should have never known any gangsters, he says to Anita. But that started so long ago, before you were born. Once you get in bed with those boys, you don't get out again. The union was a rough bunch in those days. You think we're tough now. You should have seen us then. And the big manufacturers, they all hired hooligans to kill us and keep the union out. We hired muscle to get the union in. Only once we were in, we couldn't get rid of the muscle. Reminiscent of that one line out of The Godfather, you know,
try to get out and they shuck you back in.
So actual historical events and figures in labor relations end up as part of the plot. So for example, in one that is really quite something, J.R. Hoffman's book, The Target, Union Buster and Corporate Takeover star Frank Lorenzo ends up as a thinly veiled bad guy in the novel. Or in plot allusions, so assassinated mine worker reform leader Jock Jablonski is mentioned in Tannenbaum before Red Henny is killed. So you actually get the historical allusion. One of the interesting glaring omissions is Jimmy Hoffa, who only ends up being mentioned in one of the novels. Right? Allusions to his disappearance and murder are scant, and the trucking industry, as you can tell from the list that I laid out, did not make it at all onto the list, which I find very, very interesting. Now, there are a number of the novels which focus on rather interesting facets of contemporary union action and tactics, like the use of a funeral as demonstration in Chinatown organizing at the opening of the Roseanne novel, Bitter Feast. Some of the other novels are rich in their context. So the feminism, unbelievable feminism, of Jenny Scholten's novel of organizing the San Francisco strippers, the anti-closure movement in Lipinski, Fault Honors, the post-regulation world of Hoffman, and the acknowledgement of America's changing landscape, the job landscape, in Kate Ellison's novel, Software Workers, all of those are especially noteworthy. Let me just give you a quote from Ellison. So they're in a bar where they organize, and one character says the other, geek labor. And Marcy goes on saying, geek labor, right, nerds on the march. Who knows, but this is the beginning of a massive movement, one that will transform the face of business in the 21st century. Right? Very self-aware. Now, the majority of these novels take a sympathetic view of workers and unions. And in fact, unions and workers are victorious in their strife or organizing drive in the majority of novels. Though union leaders are often the bad guys, it also is true that many of the novels use the labor relations thread as a red herring in the mystery in many of these. So you think the union's the bad guy, and it turns out they're actually not. In fact, redeeming the union leader is a really good person in a couple of the cases. So from Les Roberts' book, The Cleveland Local, as one character says to the other, look, I'm not sitting here saying that there aren't any corrupt unions anymore or any corrupt guys in them. But for the most part, they're on the up and up. Jimmy Hoffa's been dead for a long time. You sure? The hero says. He just might be showing up with Elvis at the local dairy queen. So the union leader goes on. He ignored me. And even though labor has lost a few sharp teeth, most of the working people in this country can thank God for trade unionism. Now, the quality of all the novels that are on the list that I handed out vary dramatically. Some are abysmal in the case of Sandra Brown, while others really come closer to classic literature in the case of David Lynn. And as you notice, Lynn's book is actually, Lynn is the former editor, I believe, of the Canyon Review, and it was published by Carnegie Mellon Press. So what you really get is pretty much a piece of literature. But taken together, they all paint a very interesting portrait through the mystery novel of labor relations in the last 30 years. So I look forward to your questions at the end of everyone's. Thanks so much.
Any comment or questions?
Well, actually, why don't we take all of the presentations and do comments and
do it that way?
Make good notes.
Yeah.
Cabin. Beach. Thank you.
the reason I did that was because it's the only place in the UK that has the archives of the maps. So it was impossible to come out with that, but we are chosen the okay, my talk is confused because the importance of self-consciousness, reading Genevieve Taggart in the context of the maps. Taggart was a poet and activist who was vocal on the American left from the 1920s until about the 1940s. As such, she belongs to a generation of American political poets whose work has been largely forgotten as a result of the post-war new critical literary paradigm that enjoyed enduring success in an effort to separate politics from poetry as part of the public positioning in defense of literature in the wake of political turmoil. Taggart participated fully in animated cultural and literary scenes surrounding the American Communist Party during the Depression era. When the influential feminist magazine New Masses was founded in 1926, she became a contributing editor. Taggart's contribution to the magazine involved her participation in a range of intellectual debates and the publication of several of her poems within its pages. While a small body of criticism on Taggart's work has focused on the analysis of her published volumes of poetry, this paper will give a fresh reading of her work that pays explicit attention the typographical, artistic, and discursive context in which it would have been most widely appreciated through its publication in New Masses. In so doing, I'm adopting a methodology that is tethered to the poetics of the political movement, the political movement in which her work is written, in which poetry both expressed and enacted the process of collaborative socio-political engagement. Through adopting this approach, this paper will investigate Taggart's specific contribution to the articulation of the poetics of class consciousness within the 30s literary left. Writing in his introduction to New Masses, an anthology of the Rebel 30, which was published in 1969, Maxwell Geismar discusses the specific way in which remembrance of New Masses had to be suppressed in order not to disrupt the revisionist and communist narrative of American cultural history that emerged during the 40s and 50s. Geismar describes clearly the sense of alienation from his own cultural memory that he experienced in the wake of the 1940s. He writes, quote, "As a literary critic emerging from the 1930s, I wondered particularly why I had so misunderstood the epoch of my own youth. I'd always thought of the 30s as a brilliant, lively, exciting, and hopeful period. However," he continues, "I was wrong, it seemed. I had been deceived. The 30s had been a period of deceit and disenchantment, of failure and frustration, of political conspiracy and agitprop." For Geismar, the culture of the Cold War period invalidates his positive memory of left literature of the 30s. New Masses, in particular, was the subject of intense revisionism. Geismar argues, and quote, "I remember the New Masses, but it was the New Masses in particular which was at the center of all this revisionist history in the 40s and 50s. It was New Masses in particular which was the object of abuse, attack, invective, and the ponderous accusations." The central role which was played by New Masses in shaping left literary culture of the period is indicated by the force of its subsequent suppression. Geismar concludes, quote, "If the 30s were to be blocked out completely from the national consciousness, as dangerous a thing for a nation as for an individual, then the New Masses was at the centre of what appears to be a cultural and literary trauma, and what we have recently discovered to be a cultural and literary fix. In reinvestigating the historical and cultural processes which have informed subsequent understandings of the 30s, particular attention then must be paid to New Masses as occupying an important yet contested position within discourses surrounding the 30s literary left. The experience of reading poetry published in the intertextual format of a critical magazine implicates the reader in a process that unsettles reading practices associated with high culture, practices which pay deference to ideas of authorial and formal integrity. The semiotic experience constructed by a journal such as New Masses reinforces an overt political aim to challenge dominant ideas of bourgeois objectivity and therefore make possible the awakening of class consciousness. Indeed, New Masses in particular utilize design elements intended to foster a sense of direct collective participation among its readers. The paper on which New Masses was printed was cheap. The magazine was intended to be used rather than coveted. Features of New Masses, such as the regular Between Ourselves column, which is basically a design page for a communist, create a coercive sense that the reader is to view himself as a valued comrade, a trusted collaborator whose active reading establishes his position firmly in the know. Critic Michael Thurston notes that, quote, "Like the frequent and very pointed cartoons, New Masses is parodies, articles, script reviews, and even advertisements share an aggressive tone and a fairly coherent, though by no means unified point of view. Overall, 13 concludes, the new methods convey, even construct, community amongst readership through layouts, designs, editorial policies and statements, and the course of the text the magazine circulates. Further, the self-referential and mutually supportive nature of left-wing periodicals in general at the time fostered a sense of collective collaboration, standing in marked contrast to spaces of high cultural magazines such as The Dial, whose austere design signaled its unique presence as a cultural artifact. The publishing practices of the left were deliberately intertextual, providing a discursive framework that supported a political enterprise of mass collective social action. However, more than just engendering a sense of comradeship, to read a magazine like New Masses was to submit to an experience where you, as a reader, would have your sense of self fundamentally challenged. As you can see, the surface irony of this May 1936 appeal, which is printed in the New Masses, which I get more subscribers, the irony is only it just mitigates the subtle threat of the advert's claim that you'll never be the same now that you have read New Masses. Clearly, the language was intended in an ironic fashion to arouse interest through its dramatic effect. However, the truth from which this irony is generated is that left-wing periodicals such as New Masses did intend to fundamentally change the way in which their readers understood their relationship of self to society, with the juxtaposition and creation of a broad intertextual framework deliberately unsettling dominant bourgeois understandings of the self, a scene that has been determined by an identifiably unique subjective experience. Bridging the typographical and ontological divide in this effort between the prior self to which one will never return, the post-facto self, indelibly stamped by the mark of the New Masses, is Kipwan's prescription that's positioned, as you can see in the lower half of the advert, cutting through the thick black line that would arrest every page. Visually, the positioning of the coupon suggests that subscription to the New Masses offers a means to participate continuously in the reconfiguration of the self performed through reading this periodical. The ultimate suggestion is that subscription will facilitate the perpetuation of this reinvention, relinquishing the laborious necessity of the weekly rush to the newsstand. As the advert queries, why miss a single issue? Indeed, why lapse so graciously into your former sense of self? I will now move on to the discussion of position of Haggard's work in relation to this challenge to ideas of selfhood and their expression that was advanced by the discussions of the left as part of collective efforts to articulate an alternative to class consciousness. Haggard in particular challenges deep notions of plural integrity and intentionality, and a dominant critical perspective that unconsciously adopted these ideas at the starting point of any subsequent critical exegesis. Her article entitled Romanticism and Communism, which was published in the September 25th, 1934 edition of New Masses, explicitly attacks the idea of the individual and the concomitant excessive of individual expression that she argues Romanticism supports. Bluntly, she states that, quote, communism implies a faith that cannot be reconciled to the truth of the Declaration of Independence and Rousseau's social contract in Shelley's poetry. Communism is based on a much deeper understanding of man. In this article, Taggart argues that the enduring legacy of Romanticism has prevented the development of a critical practice based on assumptions other than that which support bourgeois ideas of the relationship between self and society. She argues that, quote, we are so much part of Romantic ideology that we find it hard to realize all the Romantic dogmas are mere half-truths. Addressing the role of criticism in perpetuating this ideology, she continues, if we had more critics who were not bound to their middle class ends, we would be aware of the very significant fact that in general, all literature, before the rise of middle class power in the 19th century, proceeded from a different set of assumptions. In her understanding, communism involves an explicit critique of a romantic discourse of selfhood. She writes, quote, in Marxian theory, as I hope I am understanding it, is a principle that contradicts the spirit of 19th century romanticism. The doctrine that man is essentially good and essentially protectable has been fully exploited by capitalism. In Taggart's view, communism embodies a social vision that exposes the falsity of the dichotomy between self and society that she feels is supported by romanticism. She argues, quote, the futile dilemma of the liberal and the romanticist, individual versus society, is a false and manufactured, not an inevitable problem. In her interpretation, communism dissolves the premise on which this dilemma is based, allowing for an understanding of the individual only in terms of the society of which he is a part. Indeed, in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels drew on Hegel's historicization of the process of self-conception in attempting to articulate an idea of subjectivity removed from any essentialist or attempt to work on quality. They argue that, quote, man's ideals, views, and conceptions, in one word, man's consciousness, changes with every change in the conditions of his material existence, in his social relations, and in his social life. Following Marx and Engels' critique of the fact that social consciousness of past ages has historically made possible the exploitation of one part of society by the other, Tagore maintains that, quote, communism is moral in the only true sense. It insists that the individual finds himself in relation to the people with whom he lives. For Tagore, art plays an important function in allowing the individual to correctly perceive his place in society. In her opinion, the significatory function of art is determined by social perception. She writes, quote, meaning implies audience, implies society. Tagore's view of the social determination of artistic power emphatically involves a specific attentiveness to the nature of language as a social tool. She, I quote, words have no meaning except in context, that is, in relation to each other. The test of a good poet then lies in his ability, quote, I think, his ability to define the emotional and intellectual power of words in relation to the mind of an audience. Importantly, Tagore's advocacy of artistic practices, which recognize and capitalize on their own social function, involves an explicit critique of the idea of the individual self, which she argues is being supported by Romanticism. She writes forcefully, quote, only after the false principle of the individual, a little universe hanging away from all the rest of life, has been ridiculed to death, can the proper function of poetry be understood. Poetry which challenges an aesthetic of individualism can therefore be an important tool in the face of communism. Tagore concludes her article by arguing that, quote, the best art is the work of society. The artist is the only efficient cause. Poetry is only vitality, like the vitality of society, by the communist. Her argument that the false principle of the individual self must be ridiculed to death in order for the political function of poetry to be realized echoes contemporary poet Edmund Rolfe's declaration in his 1931 poem Credo that, quote, to welcome multitudes, the miracle of deeds performed in unison, the mind must first renounce the fiction of the self. For both Tagore and Rolfe, the mass political movement necessary to the establishment of communism is predicated on the development of poetics to support the articulation of a collective consciousness and one which interrogates the reductive traditions of expression. In this introductory frontispiece to a November 2nd, 1938 edition of her collected poem, Tagore states that since the earliest attempts at verse, I have tried to use the I in a poem only as a means for transferring meaning to identification with anyone who takes the poem voluntarily for his own. I is then adjusted to the voice of the reader. Thesis that Tagore outlines in Romanticism and Communism accords with the poetics of the new masses itself, which, as I discussed earlier, attempts to redefine the social function of poetry in order to challenge dominant views of the relation between self and society. In this respect, her work contributes to a deeper and more wide-ranging discourse among the 30s left that sought to challenge notions of bourgeois subjectivity and work towards the development of poetics of class consciousness. To demonstrate how her theory relates to practice, I'll finally turn my attention to her poem, The Definition of Song, which was published in the May 19th, 1936 edition of New Masses. Printed in the same edition as the advertisement I showed earlier for subscription, the poem substantiates the theoretical position that I've outlined. The definition of song is explicitly concerned with the social function of art. The poem opens with the line, singing is best, it gives right joy to speech. Tagore's celebration of song is explicitly tied to a recognition of the social function of art and critique of artistic practices that support ideals of individualism. Again, in the second stanza, Tagore argues, and of all forms of song, surely the least is solo, thus continuing the attack on the reductive tradition of lyric expression advanced earlier in her article Romanticism and Communism. This poem provides an alternative view of art as a social force. Quote, so singing is the work of many voices. Art that realizes the full potential of its cultural function provides an aesthetic framework that allows people to see themselves in relation to a broader social reality. Quote, for only so when Karl Marx rejoices is the lot sprung on human isolation, and of all the many well just one. Participating in a broader critique of bourgeois subjectivity present within the literary left, Tagore's description here of a process through which the self is both physically and metaphysically refashioned reflects a similar process described by Rolfe in his poem to my contemporaries, where he states, quote, "It is pain to surrender the fugitive fragments of an earlier self, but the break must be made, the artery severed, and sewed again, the useless nerve numbed." Both Taggart and Rolfe envisage a poetics wherein self-perception becomes remade in terms of the altered social relations placed into a less forceful ideal. Consciousness will be fashioned anew. Quote, "You'll never be the same again." Drawing on a lexicon of bondage, Taggart's image of the lock from the strong recalls Marx and Engels' theory of declarations that the proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. Art, then, is presented here as capable of loosening the fetters of subjective consciousness. Moving to the fourth stanza, Taggart focuses more specifically on material and social function of literature. In the definition of song, her rejection of individualism likewise involves an affirmation of the powerful nature of literature as a material tool capable of enacting social and physical change. She instructs her readers, quote, "Swing the great stanza on the pavement, use the public street for publishing good news." Clearly, Taggart argues that communal poetics should provide aesthetic support to a social ideal, and, quote, "deepest of all, essential to the song of the common good." She adopts a metaphorical understanding of the relationship between body and state that supports a subtle conflation of individual with communal experience. An individual step in this poem is simultaneously the mark of multitude. Quote, "song is not static, joy becomes a dance, and set back unison in step advance." The poem concludes with a resounding affirmation of the capacity of art to set in motion this mass revolutionary movement. Quote, "This is the life of song, does it mean and move, and save the massive power of our love." This poem, then, ultimately gives affirmative expression to the choral poetics of the literary context in which it was published, where, as critic Carrie Nelson argued, no poem lived explicitly within its own boundaries, and where poetry was regarded as a transformative political force in its own right.
Thank you, Gavin. Magnus?
The aim of this paper is to analyse Swedish working class literature in the context of class and class struggle. My main theoretical inspiration in this endeavour is the anti-essentialist and dialectical Marxian theory presented by Stephen A. Resnick and Richard P. Moore. With point of departure in this theory, I investigate the overdetermined relationship between Swedish working class literature and the era of the Swedish welfare state and other processes within this social society, especially the economic process of class, the political process of class struggle, and the cultural processes involved in the production and distribution of specific meanings pertaining to the nature of class. The status in Sweden for working class literature is unparalleled in any other capitalist country. Since the 1930s, it has constituted a central tradition in Swedish literature, and today, working class writers occupy dominant positions in the literary field. The standard account of the tradition of Swedish working class literature goes as follows. Working class literature first emerged in the labour movement during the last decades of the 19th century, mainly in the form of political poetry and songs. Around 1910, it had its first breakthrough in the literary sphere, when a group of proletarian writers became successful among both critics and readers with realistic novels about the working class. This success was, however, followed by a period of relative marginalisation of working class writers, which lasted until the second and final breakthrough in the 1930s. During this decade, a large group of writers had a breakthrough, mainly with autobiographical proletarian novels. After World War II, many of the working class writers of the 1930s continued to hold dominant positions in the literary field. This is evidenced, for example, by the fact that three of them Otto Lundqvist, Ludvig Jonsson, and Harry Martinsson were elected members of the Swedish Academy, and the two of them, Jonsson and Martinsson, were awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1974. During this period, working class writers also managed to reach out to large numbers of readers, often through popular editions of their novels from the 1930s, distributed through cultural organizations associated with the labor movement. At the same time, younger working class writers were often marginalized in the literary sphere. During the late 1960s and 1970s, however, a new generation of working class writers emerged. Some of them used documentary or modernist forms, but many also wrote realist prose fiction. In the 1980s, the status of Swedish working class fiction reached an all-time low. But in the 1990s, it regained some of its status, and during the last decade, working class literature has once again become a central strand in Swedish literature. Among the most important Swedish working class writers today are, of course, Linda Borg and Susanna Alakoski, who both had a breakthrough with autobiographic novels. But contemporary Swedish working class writers also write modernist and postmodernist poetry, experimental prose fiction, experimental works, etc. According to Resnick and Wolff, class is the process of production, appropriation, and distribution of surplus labor. And this process takes place in an overdetermined social totality, alongside other processes, which, for analytical purposes, can be divided into economic, political, natural, and cultural processes. Cultural processes are processes of the production and circulation of meaning. One important consequence of the conceptualization of the relationship between cultural processes and other processes in a social society as overdetermined is that the former can't be understood to contain their own conditions of existence as their essences. Instead, the specific forms in which art, music, literature, and other cultural processes exist must be viewed as the combined result of other social processes, including class processes. Another important consequence is that cultural processes must be seen as containing some of the conditions of existence of other processes, including, once again, class processes. This is underlined by Resnick and Wolff in the book Knowledge and Class, where they point out that the cultural process of advertising makes possible class processes within companies, and that the cultural process of public education makes possible class processes in society in general. In the book Class Theory and History from 2002, Resnick and Wolff summarized their view of the relationship between class and culture in the following way. I quote, "Culture is always complex, diverse, and overdetermined by many aspects of society other than the lattice class structure. Our argument is not that the class structure could or would alone determine a culture that was functional to its survival. We seek only to establish the point that for class structures to exist and survive, that cultural context must provide some of the requisite conditions, however complicated by cultural cross-currents." Thus, class and culture are, as Eric Schoffer puts it, continually intertwined in an overdetermined relationship, where each combines with additional processes to provide the conditions of existence for the other. Or, in other words, cultural processes, such as literature, actively participate in shaping the social totality, including its class processes, at the same time as they are shaped by all other processes occurring within this totality. With the point of departure in this conceptualization of the relationship between culture and class, I want to propose that Swedish working class literature could be conceptualized in analogy with Resnick and Wolff's understanding of Marxian theory. In Knowledge and Class, Resnick and Wolff argue that Marxian theory has two objectives. The first is to produce a class knowledge of society, to construct the kind of knowledge of the overdetermined hence contradictory and changing social totality as focuses on class. The second objective is to help change the class structure of the social formation. Because of this, Marxian theory struggles for social hegemony with other theories, which construct different kinds of knowledge and thus affects the class structure in society in different ways. And since the object of these struggles is the process of class, they are class struggles. that working class literature could be viewed in analogy with Marxian theory, i.e. as an overdetermined cultural process producing representations of class and thus engaged in class struggle. It's not a very novel or original idea. In the book The Marxian Imagination, for example, Julian Marcus argues that authors stand in the same relationship to the world as literary and cultural theorists, since their aim is to change the world indirectly through discourse. And in the book Vanishing Moments, Eric Schoppe claims that the modes through which writers have engaged the working class and the poor reflect an ongoing perceptual struggle that is part of class relations. How then has Swedish working class literature participated in class struggle? In order to shed some light on this question, I'll make a brief analysis of the relationship between this literature and the hegemonic understanding of class during the era of Swedish welfare capitalism. The Swedish welfare state emerged in the 1930s, had its golden age in the decades following World War II, and started to crackle in the 1970s. As a social formation, it's best understood as what Johan Hirvon has called a popularly organized capitalism. The vital condition of existence for this social formation was the assertion of a hegemonic reformist consensualism in Swedish politics and Swedish society. And one important aspect of this spirit was, as has been underlined by several scholars, a relative marginalization of questions about class. During the era of welfare capitalism, Swedes were viewed first and foremost as citizens, not as members of classes. Another important aspect was the emergence of a corporatist imagining of the social totality as a social whole where individuals are bound together through a web of mutual obligations and where class relations consequently are not characterized by antagonism. One of the most interesting Swedish working class writers of the immediate post-war era is Folke Fridell. On the cover of his breakthrough novel, Dead Man's Hand, or Dead Man's Hand, from 1946, the publisher stresses that the reality described in the novel is radically at odds with the very concept of the worker state. And this description is indeed correct. For in the novel, Fridell paints a very dark picture of the conditions of the Swedish working class in the worker state, a condition characterized by exploitation and alienation. And the only utopian solution suggested in the narrative is, in the words of one of the characters, that the workers should be allowed to share the profits and have a stake. And this requires, according to the novel's protagonist, that class cooperation is replaced by class struggle. The radical representation of class in Fridell's Dead Man's Hand, of course, made the author a target of critique from both the reformist labor movement and from bourgeois critics. This is thematized in his next novel, Get the Volna, The Grip Gets Tighter, from 1948. The protagonist in this novel is the author of the previous one, and as such he is criticized by representatives of the bourgeoisie for representing the world only from the workers' perspective, and by workers for focusing only upon exploitation and alienation while ignoring the increased standard of living for workers in the welfare state. This is bad pictures. But another important working class writer from the decades after World War II is Kurt Salomonsson. In his debut novel from 1956, Grottorna, The Caves, he tells the story of a journalist who starts working in a mine in northern Sweden and discovers that the workers are subjected to merciless exploitation. Salomonsson's representation of class injustice is clearly at odds with the hegemonic corporatist imagining of the social totality. And this is thematized in his novel, where class injustice is described as a hidden injustice, and the protagonist is criticized by both workers and employers for trying to sabotage the allegedly mutually beneficial cooperation between workers and capitalists on which the working state rests. Neither Fridell nor Salomonsson managed to become dominant actors in the literary field. But in the late 60s and early 70s, a young generation of working-class writers did. Two of these were Sara Lidman and German Palm, who both published documentary books about the working class. In 1968, Sara Lidman, together with the photographer Ulf Lundblom, published a book-long reportage about mine workers entitled Gruva, Mine. In this book, the rhetoric of the class-led welfare state is repeatedly juxtaposed with the insistence that the workers are exploited and that their economic and political interests are thus antagonistic to the interests of other classes. 1 year after the publication of this book, 5,000 Swedish mine workers went on strike. This was one of the first major strikes in Sweden after World War II, and, as Arnold Lilith has pointed out, it has often been interpreted as an important rupture in the hegemonic self-understanding of the Swedish welfare state. Within the Red Communist Labour movement, Lindman was often condemned as one of the instigators of this strike. In 1972, Göran Palm published another footlong reportage about the Swedish workers, Ett år Gällen, 1 year at Gällen, written during the year when the author worked in a telephone factory in Stockholm. Palm's purpose with the book was to help workers become class conscious. And one of his strategies for achieving this was to subject various representations of the working class, including representation of workers as having common interests with capitalists, to ideology critique. In his next book, Bokslut on LM, Closing the Books on LM, from 1974, Palm continues his discussion of the class character of the Swedish workers' day. But he also comments on the critical reception of his previous book by both representatives of the Red Communist Labour Movement and representatives of the telephone company where it worked. Now, during the era of Swedish welfare capitalism, working class writers repeatedly and self-consciously challenged the hegemonic self-understanding of the Swedish welfare state as a society without class antagonism. Thus, these writers were engaged in cultural and class struggle. To which extent these struggles have affected the overall class struggles in Swedish society is, of course, hard to assess. But the minor strike in 1969, of course, by the publication of Saladin's Lilla, is, of course, an extreme oversimplification. But the same can be said about the ruling out of the possibility that Lilla may have played an important role in the processes that led to the strike. For the necessary conditions of existence for strikes or any other form of class struggles are provided by a multitude of other processes within the undetermined totality of the social formation, including processes of production and distribution of specific meanings pertaining to the nature of class. And since the 1930s, Swedish working class literature has been one of the most important of these processes. Thank you.
Conservatism and evangelical religiosity. They're both individualistic. The evangelical theology translates into a kind of political economic individualism, so you can support the markets and the like. And this is a serious issue for any number of reasons. A lot of people have attributed what's called American exceptionalism to this, the weakness of working class politics in America. So this is kind of the question I'm taking on. I'm going to, in this talk here, I'm going to try to outline some ideas, a sort of narrative that I think could be effective in generating support for working class politics among evangelicals. I think that there are obstacles, but I think they can be overcome and at least some can be brought on board with the right narrative. And so that's the question. I should say, this issue is perhaps more serious than most people are aware, because evangelicals in America account for about anywhere between a quarter and a third of the population. So they're probably approximately 100 million people. And they are, to a very considerable extent, working class. They're spread all across the country. They're concentrated in the South. They're concentrated in the Midwest. But they're everywhere. And there was, for example, a Baylor study came out to determine that in 2006, people in America who are classified as high school or less in education level, 45% of those people were evangelicals. So a very significant chunk of the working class is are evangelical believers. So for my money, then, any kind of working class politics in America, if it had to achieve any kind of serious level of success, is going to require evangelical involvement. So that said, the essential nature of evangelical conservatism is pretty much similar to secular conservatism. It is an individualistic orientation, so the problems of material hardship, poverty, and the like should be solved through individual solutions by seizing market opportunity. Evangelicals, they tend to interpret hardship as somehow an individual shortcoming has produced this. So, for example, some people I know can be very fond of saying that poverty is a spiritual problem. But in general, one thing that distinguishes them from secular conservatives is this view that faith in Christ, being a Christian believer, will empower an individual to seize those economic opportunities, to seize existing opportunities. And so in this way, faith will have this tangible effect. Now, here's a thing that I think is important, is that this view that the individual is the problem really assumes that market distribution is just. It has that implicit assumption already built into it that the prevailing social relationships governing distribution in the society, those are consistent with distributive justice. And so the market is not a problem. So, for example, they've already implicitly excluded other options. For example, that the market contains kinds of exploitation. That's written out of their story immediately, because that's necessary for the individual to be a problem. They've already written out other kinds of forms of distribution, a more robust welfare state, something like a guaranteed annual income, classical Marxist notion that from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. These things are implicitly excluded. And so there's a kind of naturalization of the market that takes place. And I think this is really critical. And the question then is, what accounts for this naturalization? What accounts for this assumption that the market, that prevailing social relationships are just on the part of evangelical conservatives? And I think that there are two premises really that underlie this assumption. One of them is normative, and one of them is empirical. And in this sense, they're really identical to the assumptions that are governing secular conservatism as well. And the first of these premises, which is normative, I call proportionalism. And it's really, and I'll read to you a remark by William James Bryan, who is not a conservative, but he really articulates this norm very, very well. He says, 1906, he says, "Justice requires that each individual shall receive from society a reward proportionate to his contribution to society." And the People's Platform of 1892, which Bill Taft talked about, said, "Wealth belongs to him who creates it." So this is the idea, and in my opinion, this is really the core, the axiom that governs American popular thought about distributive justice, what I call proportionalism. This notion that wealth is a cumulative social product, and that each person has somehow contributed to that product to a certain degree, and that they are entitled to a share that is proportionate to or commensurate with their contribution. And so it's not an entitlement. It's not a blanket kind of entitlement sense of distributive justice. It's a kind of distributive justice dependent upon contribution. Okay, and it gets nuanced in various ways, but that is really the core doctrine, which I call proportionalism. It is very commonly expressed up in the 19th century as an agenda way. A man deserves the full fruits of his labor. Okay, so this is the idea, and this is an important concept for what I'm trying to argue. Now, the key about conservative evangelicalism is that they combine this proportionalist norm with an empirical claim, which is this: markets produce outcomes that are consistent with proportionalism. So that is to say that in market society, people are rewarded according to their contribution. The right people are getting the amount that they deserve according to their input. Now, this is what these two things together produce, this view, which I call right-wing proportionalism. And it's the view that if this is the case, if people deserve something that is equivalent to what they've contributed, and markets produce outcomes consistent with that norm, then, well, the only problem is the individual. So the individual needs to work harder, become more talented, or become sober, or whatever it is. So this is the essence, to me, of right-wing proportionalism. It is the ideology that really underlies both evangelical and secular conservatism, I think. So that's what accounts for this naturalization of the market. I will give you an example of a very prominent evangelical named E. Calvin Beister. He's a libertarian. He's active now in the conservative approach to environmental problems. So he's very libertarian in that case. He says, an economic system consistent with the Christian worldview, therefore, must reward people according to the intelligence, creativity, and diligence of their work. Only the free market does that. Coercive redistribution of wealth, therefore, violates both of these primary Christian principles, for it transgresses property protected by the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, and attempts to force what must be free. So according to this right-wing proportionalism, redistribution, state action, state involvement in the economy, transfer payments, social spending, these are all forms of theft. They're out and out theft because they're taking away from the people who created the wealth and giving them to the loafers and the shiftless. And that's the heart of the right-wing proportionalism. And it appears throughout Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, all these very prominent figures. And it's very easy to discern at the popular level as well. So the thing that I want to point out, though, is that this proportionalist norm is fundamentally ambiguous, because it's a normative principle about people deserving that which they've created, shared equal to that which they've created. But the norm itself does not specify the kinds of empirical social relationships that will produce just outcomes. Now, the right thing is the markets. They think that markets will produce those outcomes. But there's a left-wing tradition, too. And this left-wing tradition argues, rather, that, in fact, redistribution is required, even the overthrow of market society is required, to ensure that people get the full fruits of their labors. So this is left-wing proportionalism. And this is a tradition that's also very old. It's really descended from a kind of popular labor theory of value. The right-wing version today is consistent with marginalist theory, but and they've given up the labor theory of value as an objective thing. But this labor theory of value really lives on in left-wing proportionalism. It's the doctrine that redistribution is actually not really redistribution. What it is it's reclamation. It's people getting their due through state action because the market is exploited. And so I'll give you a few examples. Now, unfortunately, within evangelicalism, left-wing proportionalism has really faded throughout the 20th century. They're progressive people, but they're not articulating it according to this narrative. That the market is exploitative, that state intervention is necessary, that labor unions are necessary so that people will get the full use of their labor. Especially in the populist era, which was just rife with evangelical Protestants and very conservative Protestants, this was a common thing to say such things as a man named O.E. Enfield, who was a socialist in Oklahoma, and a millennial believer, he said in 1916 about his, he wrote this in a Christian periodical, quote, "When I became, in fact, a socialist, I beheld for the first time the monstrous evil, the source of unspeakable misery, of a very few men owning and controlling the means of production and distribution. Today, one man does nothing and has millions. Today, millions do everything and have nothing." Mary Elizabeth Lee said in a more more directly biblical sense, she said, she was a populist author at the same time and a speaker. "From the days of Esau to the present time, two classes of people have existed on this earth. The one class who lived by honest labor, the other who lived off of honest labor. The one class has lived by tilling the soil, raising the flocks and herds, over which God has given them dominion. The other class consisted of roving bandits, plundering the honest workers." And so we see that the same norm can go to the right if it endorses the market. It can go to the left in the sense that it will endorse other kinds of social relationships, labor unions, state redistribution, even socialism out and out, the total abolition of capitalist society. So what I'd like to say is that essentially this view continues to be very widespread among a lot of Americans, particularly working class Americans. It's visible in popular music, country music, for example. Dolly Parton in her song 9 to 5 says, "They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's a rich man's game, no matter what they call it. Then you spend your life putting money in his wallet." So you see, your wealth, the wealth that you're creating, is being shifted to the bosses and the capitalists. And you know, the analytical precision of these analyses is limited, but this is the idea. There was a PBS documentary called People Like Us. It was about a class a few years ago, and they interviewed a man. And actually, in the transcript, he doesn't even have a name. He's just referred to as Redneck in the transcript. they ask him, "What's class?" And he says, here's my definition. "The working class is the one that do 80% of the work and draw 10% of the pay that the work produces." That's what my definition of the working class is. So there's this. So what I'm saying is there's this tradition of left-wing proportionalism. And it's widespread, although it really doesn't reach the level of popular media, and certainly no one in the political realm is expressing it. But I think in this fashion, I think that evangelicals, to a considerable degree, can be made sympathetic to working class politics and supportive of. There's an E.P. Thompson quote that I take heart from making the English working class. He says, "Behind every form of popular direct action, some legitimizing notion of right is to be found." So we're back in blood, but this is the idea that we need a narrative. We need something that will inspire. We need something that will make people sacrifice and will see the justice of their own cause. And my view is that proportionalism this is a pre-existing ethical norm. And so what we need to do, the argument needs to be that state action, labor unions, perhaps even more radical things, are necessary to ensure that people get the full rewards of their labor, to see that they do get remuneration commensurate with their inputs, and that it's got a class analysis built into it. On the evangelical front, these kinds of themes resonate very much with a lot of some of the denunciations of the Old Testament prophets against the oppressors, against exploitation. This is not we should help the poor. This is the poor have been shafted, and they should be, and some kind of retribution is due, some kind of justice is due. And so, Book of James, I'll finish by mentioning something of that, which is James 5, for those of you who haven't read it. In the New Testament, "Go to now, you rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. Ye have heaped treasure together for the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth. And the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabbath." And so, that then is my view, is that a significant proportion, or at least an important portion of evangelical Americans can be brought over to sympathy for working class politics, support for working class politics, through the use of this narrative. It's going to take organization and various other kinds of things, but this, I think, is really a key building block to overcome the individualism and the naturalization of
Thank you. Thank you so much. That's a wonderful paper. It was just very enlightening and it's a pleasure to hear. One thing that I struggle with as an activist and as a writer is how you can attack the right wing, right wing ideas in an individual, in one on one. In the Trump, in the Trump co-worker, for example, most of the women I work with are very evangelical. Now, how can I attack their economic line without attacking your God? If I attack your God, forget about it, I'm dead on the water. I find that a very difficult proposition. And in the literary scene, how do I attack this economic, the cultural process that justifies or reinforces the economic exploitation without it sounding like a speech? You know, without being, you know, an argument dressed up as a character that really isn't a joke. And so in both these ways I struggle all the time, and any advice you can give me, I would be very grateful to believe. Very grateful.
Well, in general, I would say maybe one of the first things you should remind them is that there are many people who share their religious beliefs but don't share their political economic views. And so that's important. And maybe discuss some of this old tradition. And, maybe draw on some of the scriptural passages where there is denunciation. Say, well, look, you know, here's the prophet Amos. And see what he says about the rich and about justice.
Right.
And to then have solid empirical examples about the present kind of exploitation that's going on. I think that's the way to go.
So, my comment is along the last program. You seem to be more optimistic than I am. You think it's possible to win over the even they are using notion of proportionalism, which at least in appearance has something in common with left-wing proportionalism. I go back to Hindu scriptures. You know, we have very popular, both in our great tradition and little tradition, a scripture called Ramayana, which has two characters, one good character, the other bad character. And the bad character is in dialogue with the messenger of the good character, and he says something very interesting. The messenger of the good character is telling him that religion is this, the sin is this. He looks at him and says, look, I know what religion is, I don't believe in it. I know what sin is, I don't abstain from it. So, as far as right-wing populism is concerned, what they are doing, they are taking the language of the left-wing and deliberately using it for a bad purpose. It's not that they don't understand it. And the point is made very well by E.P. Thompson in his letter to Karkowski, that it is not that right-wing anti-Marxist intellectuals don't understand Marxism, they are reading Marxism to distort Marxism, they are making career out of it. And of course the universities are an example of that, how people have made their career by distorting Marxism. I'm a sociologist, I read sociology, more intelligent people who are far more intelligent, have better understanding of English. You can see I speak Chichi English with the starters. But how come they do not understand those simple writings of Marx and read Max Weber, which distorts Marx? So the problem is a little bit more than just the question of understanding and winning over writing, which of course that you are saying you are more optimistic or not. There is a more deliberate political kind of problem that there is one.
Okay.
Well, I was glad to hear that evangelicals are only 30-40% of the population. In my local, it's much higher. And an issue that I'm president of the United Auto Workers Local Union, and the issue that I see that divides evangelicals really comes to the question of whether religion prohibits you from engaging in the struggle to change the relations of social norms today, or whether it doesn't. And clearly there are those who project that it's okay today. That the whole basis of their religion is that it's okay today. Whatever it is, however oppressive it is, it's okay because it's God's will. Versus those who equally believe in God, but believe that God has given them the ability to think, to act, to take action, that God helps those who help themselves. And that understanding that division was very important to me in terms of being able to be a minority in my local and yet be accepted by, as they say, a majority evangelical local. And I really appreciated John's presentation and the because I think that the absence of culture centered in the working class is part of why we don't think of ourselves as working class. And looking at an area like mysteries, I thought was a worthy way of looking at this question. I would just to round out your survey. I'll tell you that there was a book that was written in the mid-80s called Stamping Out Murder by James Link. It's not that great a mystery, but the interesting thing about it was that he was running for chief steward, and the hero of the book was himself a steward who was working on a solving a murder case in the factory, much like the one that Jim worked in. And what Jim did was he distributed a chapter of his book to Bleak leading up to his election. He was successful getting him elected. And the other thing I just wanted to mention, to me, one of the best mysteries involving labor is John Danzy's Blood Brotherhood, which is a fictionalized account of the murder of Dow Wilson and the painters in the San Francisco Bay Area, and written a little bit before the time period he covered.
Okay, we're going to go that, and if you can keep it to 90 seconds each, it will bring us some time.
So, Michael Boyle, I think that was an excellent presentation, and there are examples of left-wing proportionalism, as you described, certainly in the South. The Southern Tenant Farmers Association in the 1930s is a wonderful example. Their needs were like camp, very religious, and yet at the same time, labor meetings. Later on, the textile workers in the 1970s were on the way, and in the 1990s again. And so there are opportunities. I think the evangelical sort of image and message begin to change with the television evangelicals, with Jim Baker and Pat Robertson, and people, and they sort of captured the image, but there, I think there is an opportunity. I'm optimistic. Well, there's a possibility or anybody.
Yeah, I was wondering about the evangelicals who accept the right-wing definition of proportionality.
Yeah.
And they themselves are not that affluent. Do they see themselves as having failed in some way, or do they see themselves as actually doing fine?
Ask you again.
Okay.
No, I got it.
We're just all trying to wait for the comments, and then maybe we'll.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a real fast one. I'm just going to say I'm working class Catholic, so I'm not so familiar with the evangelical. But I got to say, in academia, which is where I'm hoisting my flag these days, there is this prejudice against people who have faith. And I'm not saying anything in this room. My simple question is. How do we overcome, because I think you're onto something, Michael, how do we reach these people if we're going to be talking down to them? And I'm not saying anybody in this room, but, there is this lack of respect that I've had friends put on a faux Catholic accent, and I could do my bad hillbilly, that, nobody in their right mind would ever use to disagree with an African-American or a gay person. And there is a lack of respect that is not realizing that there was a Southern Tenant Farmer Union, there is a Catholic Worker Union movement, liberation theology, etc. And the same thing with popular culture. Like sometimes you say to work, working class people, you read murder mysteries or you listen to Dolly Parton and do an intellectual fade,
Yes, two questions. One for me. Your argument, I think, is very good. It cannot be extended beyond Christianity. It seems to be one of the problems that is most. Here in Europe, particularly, I know it's not even Islamophobia, the people on the left, but if you're a Muslim, it's assumed that you're some sort of Gajfari and so on. This is it's up there, the same argument can be made with evangelical Christianity that applies to Islam as well. It's a broad house to be made from positions, and that kind of, you know, just on the sort of, not least on the left and along here, that kind of thing, seems to be really important in the way you argue. Carl, more specifically, it's about the relationship of New Masters and Stalinism and its cultural shifts throughout the country. Because some sort of adoption of the front in 1995 is clearly in the violently anti Muslimist position taken by communist journals, TSLAs, people, and so on. And it seems that the discussion about what they're saying is a much more complex position than that. And it's one that we should survive. In that kind of position, the kind of alignment seems to be much more sophisticated than the kind of Stalin's position with the corruption of the funds.
Let me have the panel respond. Clearly, evangelicalism is it's a touchstone in America. Just across the railway tracks is the Stony Brook School, which was founded by one of the great counter movements that used to come from the city, set up tents in the summer, and have evangelical meetings in the early 1900s, and this area was developed into what is now a boarding school, a good boarding school, but it's very evangelically based, right next to a very, very diverse public university in a very conservative village. So you've got these odd mixes that go on all the time. I think that's clearly part of the beauty of America.
Well, a couple, I guess, quick comments on my optimism. I hesitate to apply that to myself, but I think that the time is so serious, and just do what we can. But in general, I think that the issue is that there's kind of a distinction, I would say, between the those evangelicals who are very sophisticated, right-wing proportionalist conservatives, who can articulate liberal ideology and property rights and all the rest of it, and then the majority of the people who are, have certain political meanings, and they kind of think individuals are the problem, but are themselves working class. And what I'm saying is that a portion of those people can be won. And the zealots, break them off. They can go down the ship. As far as people who are themselves poor, working class, struggling, my experience has been that people who stay in churches tended to maintain a certain level where it's not absolutely indigent and squalor. And so there's a kind of level of maybe some hardship, but the community will get through. There's kind of help available, and people are plugged into networks. And so those who stay in the church do sustain a certain standard of living where things are more than tolerable or tolerable, and they will not have any disquiet in their thinking that this is just a temporary phase, that the hereafter is where they're going to have their riches. And so that's kind of the situation. Anybody else?
Well, let me just pick up on Michelle's question and your comment. One thing to bear in mind is I think a good amount of evangelicals that you were trying to get at also believe that the Donald Trumps of the world are profligate and don't deserve what they have. And so that there's this kind of not so much that that's proof positive that they deem the best people, but that Paris Hilton is an example of the worst people, right, in that one. But the one quote that I would give you, and many other people probably would use it, is I constantly quote Bill Haywood, who said, for every man there is who has a dollar you can work for, there's somebody who worked for a dollar that you can get. And that's the easiest proportionality, I think, that you can understand, even without the crummy credibility to each other needs. It hammers at home very quickly. Now, one question I would give to Magnus, just because I think other people might be interested, are any of the novels that you were citing in translation?
Yeah, some of them. Most of them are translated from German, French, Spanish, Russian. Some continue to go there.
Raise a question. Karen hasn't had a chance to talk, and I'm wondering if you effectiveness of the poetry and reactions to it?
Effectiveness in terms of actually getting people to think in terms of what's the question.
Were people never the same again once they...
what's interesting, actually, there's a book called The Romantic American Communism by Vivian Gornick, and she interviews people who had been members of the American Communist Party in the 30s, 40s, and she interviewed them in the 1970s, I think. She talks about the devastating psychological impact which the fall of the USSR actually had on people, and they kind of experienced the Khrushchev of 1956 as like a breakdown in their own personal psychological narrative. So to me, reading those interviews in that book, kind of thought, well, actually, yeah, their sense of identity was so fundamentally constructed in relation to some of the narratives they experienced and had in reading this literature. But yeah, I think
the
psyche birds, on its head. Could I just ask one question? First of all, I thought all the papers from the time took a lot of this, but going back to the evangelicals, I'm a working class atheist who was baptized out of Baptist, so I have some roots in that and a lot of others. I can have those discussions that you were talking about on an economic level. But what about when we enter the modern level, like women's rights, gay rights? That's when we use the name that really matters.
You're right.
Yeah,
I think there's less flexibility on a lot of those issues, like the life issues.
First of all, I haven't given it as much thought, but when I have thought about it, I've been.
Okay, last.
I just want to say, also, it was a great panel, and I think what I think Joe said and what you said were really important. But the Center for Working Class Studies, we're constantly asked about questions about the working class and religion, their conservatism, which are just completely off the wall. And I remember one particular discussion we were having with the Ford Foundation brought up all their people and doing all their identities, class, race, and gender. And we just listened to the discussion, but not too long after the Ohio election, and Ohio gives the election to Bush, and everybody was complaining, what's wrong with Ohio and all those evangelical churches in southern Ohio. And the knowledge about those evangelical churches was so limited because those large churches were multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-class, and evolved, evangelical movement that evolved from Southern California working with migrants across the South and became so strong in Southern Ohio and Indiana and places like that. But they provided enormous support for working people. And if you were a secular humanist and the people on campus, or the rationalists, or however you want to talk about academics sometimes, there was a type of dismissiveness. The problem with the Catholic situation was that they have an incredible body of work on Catholic social teaching on work, but all the priests and the Catholics, a large number of them, except for the immigrants, are moved to the suburbs. And I remember talking at Notre Dame to George Higgins and Patrick Sullivan, who were the last two great labor priests. And I said, well, what's going on in those seminaries? And Higgins, who was about 85, looked at me under his glasses the way they can look at people. And he said, litmus! In the term meaning, they're only teaching the liturgy. They're not teaching the principles of Catholicism. So I think it's really complicated, and I think Joe and your remarks are great, and the panel was great, and congratulations. Great job.
Okay, thank you.